Here, Jeff.
Does it work?
All right, I handed out these sheets to you. Has Ezekiel 14, verse 14, also verse 20, and James 5, verse 11. We count those blessed who endured. You've heard of the endurance of Job. You've seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings. Here's what I want us to look at, that the Lord is full of compassion and is merciful. Now, I've listed some questions here, and I would like some of these questions I'm going to ask at the beginning of every lesson. But you do what you want with it. Hopefully you'll fill it out. And if you fill it out in advance and then you see, well, maybe I need to change my answer, I certainly understand that. I've done that. But you can't probably do it on this sheet of paper, especially the first two. Make a general list as we study that what Job has said is wrong. There are some things he said is wrong. Make a list of things that are answered in and by or through Christ. I listed a few of those last week. Write down how Job is described in the first verse and on through here. You can look at this on your own and hopefully work with these questions here. Quick review, and I mean as quick as I can do. We looked at reaping what you sow. We looked at Job, and what he did was his children, when they got together at any time, then he would offer a sacrifice and pray to God that perhaps they had cursed God, and he was fearful that then God would destroy them, punish them, so he wanted to take care of that. Reaping what you sow. Job was a firm believer in the principle of retribution. That is, you reap what you sow. Proverbs 22:4-5 says this: the reward of humility and the fear of the Lord are riches, honor, and life. Thorns and snares are the way of the perverse. He who guards himself will be far from them. In other words, you live good, good things happen to you. You live bad, bad things happen to you. We see Galatians 6:7, for whatever a man sows, this he will also reap. And so therefore, Job believed in this principle of retribution, this principle of sowing and reaping. And so did the three friends as well. They also believed in that. So the key question in the book is, when you're looking at this book, the key question is, does Job fear God for no reason? Because Satan comes up and he basically, God calls Satan and says, have you considered my servant Job? He calls him my servant. And what does God say about Job? How does he describe Job? He describes him as one who fears God, right? Who's upright, who's blameless, who turns away from evil. There is no thing that I can think of that can be said of any greater, especially from God Himself. But Satan says, that's only because you pay him off. That's the only reason. The only reason anyone pays attention to you, God, is because you give them things, and that's the same. So does Job fear God for no reason? It's what the book's about. But when you look at this from a cynical standpoint, maybe not even realizing that, is God and Satan just playing a game with Job's life? Here is God. I have an upright, blameless, fearing servant who turns from evil. Here comes Satan. What do you think about my guy? Oh, your guy, he's in it for the stuff. Well, take the stuff away. So he does. It almost is like they're playing a game with Job. But yet he's going through horrific things and loses his family, loses his possession, loses his health. There's more to this than just a game. We talked about that last week. Amy will make copies of that. Plus, we'll get into this in more detail as well. But the key point here comes from Psalms 139, 23 to 24. This, we will do a whole lesson on this point. Search me, O God. Know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts and see if there's any hurtful way in me. And lead me in the everlasting way. Well, when we want God to do that, it can look very much like what's going on with Job. Being tried, being to see and be tested. And that's exactly what goes on. Moving on, we have the triangle of tension, which you see on the board. This goes on through the whole book between the friends. It's basically, you've got the principle of retribution as that principle that you do right, good things happen, you do wrong, bad things happen. God is just, God is righteous. Job is suffering, and Job is righteous. All three of these can't be true. They can't be. It's impossible. Either God is just, and Job, we know he's suffering, so therefore Job cannot be righteous. And that's exactly what the friends tell him. And Elihu, who comes, where does this guy come from? Shows up and says that. But Job says, no, I am righteous. And yes, I am suffering. God is not being just here. I need to talk to him. I have to talk to him. They all three believe in this principle. There's where the problem is. There's where that tension lies at. Job starts to have a breakthrough. And this is where we kind of left off at. In Job 21, 7 to 13, Job starts remembering in his life about, you know, sometimes wicked people do prosper. And in chapter 24, 5 to 12, he's seen innocent people exploited and oppressed. That doesn't fit this principle of retribution. This is a significant change from his own acceptance of this principle here. Could it be that he's kind of looking at himself? Here he is suffering as that blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. That's not just what the author says. That's what God says twice. Because he is suffering, maybe this opened his eyes up to the fact that the principle of retribution might not be unconditional. And so this is the first step that Job starts to take. But when we think about this, this principle of retribution, let me put this back up on the screen in Galatians 6, 7, and 8. Do not be deceived, Paul writes. God is not mocked. For whatever one sows, that will he also reap. For the one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption. But the one who sows to the Spirit will reap from the Spirit eternal life. How does this fit with what we learn about Job? The key here is the frame of reference. Paul's frame of reference in this passage is eternity. What Paul means is that from an eternal perspective, we will reap what we sow. The one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life. So Paul is talking about here in his teaching that there's more to our existence than this life. That there will be an afterlife. And after And what that existence in that afterlife will be like is determined how we live in this life. So it is important how we live in this life. That's how we're going to be based on the afterlife. That's where we usually use 2 Corinthians 5:10. For we all must, everyone here, must appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may be recompensed or rewarded for his deeds in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad. So everything that we've done, whether good or bad, will be brought up that day of judgment. But the question Job is dealing with is reaping and sowing in this life, not in eternity. They are struggling and fighting with the fact that, Job, you did something wrong, so therefore you're suffering in this life. Job, no, I've been righteous, so therefore this bad can't be happening, so therefore God must have this wrong. I have to take my case to God. And that's what the majority of this book goes back and forth in dealing with. The concept of afterlife and eternity is not yet revealed to Job and his friends. They can only see what's in this life. Now you might say to yourself, well, most take Job at the time of Moses, maybe even a little earlier. Or Abraham, I should say. Abraham's what I meant. And Abraham believed that his son Isaac could come back from the dead. And that's true. But that's completely different. That was Abraham feeling that he goes through with what God says to do and sacrifices his son, that God can bring him right back to life again. We're talking here of this judgment scene at the end of this life. And so the only consequence that these men are seeing is in this life. With that said, I think a lot of people think this way, but for lack of a better way, I just put down in a negative sense or an ungodly way. And let me explain what I mean by this. Nothing bad happens, so some people conclude by their thoughts, by their words and their actions, then there is no God because they see no reason for a God. Everything's good. There are a lot of people that don't believe in God and life is going smooth and nice. Then we have when bad does happen, there must not be a God, or if there is, he doesn't care because there's no consequence going on in this life. So, you know what? Just do whatever makes you happy because, you know, you're only going to live once in life. And after that, well, nothing. There's nothing. Well, there's a lot of problems with both of that. Thing is that in this life things don't always work out as smoothly as the principle of retribution. Do something wrong in this life, something wrong happens to you. Do bad things, some bad things happen to you. Or vice versa. Because sometimes wicked people prosper. Sometimes righteous people suffer. Now, the book of Proverbs, it tells us so many times that if you do the right things, more than likely good things will happen to you in this life. But that Proverbs, by their very nature, are general observations. They're not ironclad laws. And the books like Job and Ecclesiastes show that there are significant exceptions to such Proverbs. Take a look at, what does Job want? I put down there the whole book. How is Job described by the author? How is Job described by God? I'm hoping you're answering this question to yourself right now. Throughout the course of Job's speeches, both in the dialogues with the three friends and in his final monologue, there's one thing that Job repeatedly says that he desires, that he wants more than anything, and that is an audience with God. What does Job believe? Right now, Job believes God is punishing him wickedly. Unjustly, I should say, is what I mean. He's punishing him unjustly. So the number one thing to Job, and think about this, the number one thing in Job's life is right now, there's a lot of things you could fill in the blank there. What if it was you who lost your children? What if it was you who lost your servants? What if it was you that lost everything you have? What would be the number one thing on your mind? The number one thing on Job's mind is, what happened to my relationship with God? I have been blameless and upright. I have feared God. I turn away from evil. I have made a covenant with my eyes not to look in lust. I have done all these things. How is it that this is happening to me? What happened between me and my God? I must have a trial with Him. I must bring my case to Him. Given, though, that his commitment to this principle of retribution as the system of God's providence, as his justice, that's the only conclusion that an upright and blameless man like Job could come to. While his confidence in this principle of retribution is the comprehensive explanation of God's government, the way He governs, it does begin to waver later in the speeches. But Job's desire to bring his case before God does not. Job wants to bring this case before God. Can you see that? Let's take a look at these passages. Let's go to Job 9. Job chapter 9, verse 32. Job says, "For he is not a man as I am, that I may answer him," speaking of God, "that we may go to court together. There is no umpire between us who may lay his hand upon us both. Let him remove his rod from me, and let not dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak and not fear him, for I am not like that in myself." Here's Job. Let's put this as Job. Here's God as here. And what he wants is someone to go between and lay his hand on God and on him. Someone to go between. To be an umpire. That's a lot like what we talked about in our Wednesday night class. Giving God control of our heart. Who fulfills this? This is part of your list that I want you to put down. Keep track of. This is what he wants. He wants to speak with God, but he knows in his heart, God is too big and powerful. And he's afraid. He thinks he's done him wrong. I would be too. Chapter 13, verse 3 to 6. Job says, "But I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue with God. But you smear with lies, speaking of his friends. You are all worthless physicians. Oh, that you would be completely silent, and that it would become your wisdom. He's not happy with what they're saying. Let me say this about these guys that are called his friends. They came from a long distance to come to Job. They took the time to coordinate three different guys to come together when they found out about Job to go see him. They are his friends. And they sit 7 days with Job without speaking. Until I go see somebody as a friend and sit 7 days and not leave that person, I'm going to be a little, not quite as boisterous to these guys. It, sure, God reproves them and rebukes them, and the things they say are not right. But let's keep it in context as well. Job's upset. Yeah, I can see why he's upset. Go to chapter 23. Verse 3 to 7. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would learn the words which he would answer and perceive what he would say to me. Would he contend with me by the greatness of his power? No, surely he would pay attention to me. Verse 7. There the upright would reason with him, and I would be delivered forever from my judge. I can't help. I wanted to say this later, but I can't wait. No. Jesus becomes the mediator. He becomes that mediator. But he's also his advocate. He's also going to argue for him. But he's also the judge. And he also gave his life. How awesome is that? To have the mediator, the advocate, the judge, be the one who pays the price. Chapter 31. Verse 35. It says, oh, that I had one to hear me. Behold, here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. And the indictment which my adversary has written, surely I would carry it on my shoulder. I would bind it to myself like a crown. I would declare to him the number of my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him. There's verse 38, 39, and 40. This is nearly the last thing Job says. I want to see my God. What happened to our relationship? In contrast to these repeated desires to see God, to talk to Him, to talk with Him, to present His case, I have one of these questions. What is one thing that Job never ever asks God for? I debated on whether to answer this question or not. But I'm like a little kid that has a present for someone. I'm going to go ahead and do it, and we'll cover it. But you can look, and maybe you can find somewhere where I missed it. But Job, and listen, if you don't remember anything in lesson, listen to this. Never indicates anywhere that he wants his losses reversed. He never asks back for his possessions. He never asks back for his health. He doesn't even ask for his children back. Through all these losses, they're so incredibly painful. The closest that I can find is in chapter 29, verse 1 to 6. Job 29, beginning in verse 1. And Job took up his discourse and said, "Oh, that I were as in months gone by, as in the days when God watched over me." What's that mean? My relationship I used to have with them. "When his lamp shone over my head, and by his light I walked through darkness, and I was in the prime of my days, when the friendship of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, and my children were around me, when my steps were bathed in butter, and the rock poured out for me streams of oil." Out of those six verses, 4.5 of them are about his relationship that he had with God that he misses. But he also mentions his children. Job is single-minded in his desire to make his case before God. And sometimes I used to look at it that he's so angry and making these false accusations at God, and he does do that at times, but his primary driven force is, "I want the relationship I had with God back." Not, "I want my kids back." Sure, he misses them. That doesn't mean he doesn't love them. It's not that I want all my animals back and a way of income back. I want the prestige that I used to have instead of now sitting on this ash heap and people making fun of me and I'm in all this pain. No, he's not asking that. He's asking, where is my relationship with God? I want to see God. I need to talk to him and present my case. Does Job fear God for no reason? That was answered after the end of the second chapter. And that's why I said in class, Satan's not around anymore. He came around after the first time because he thought, well, okay, we took everything away from him, but let's go after him. He'll surely curse you then. And he was wrong. That's why on Facebook I put up that most people ignored. Well, when the accuser fails, he never gives up. That should light a fire under us. It seems significant to me that at the climax of the book, God gives exactly what Job wants. A personal encounter with him. Okay, what about Elihu? Job 32 to 37. Of all the great mysteries in this book, he's one of them. He seems to come out of nowhere. And after his speeches, he's gone. It's like he just came across these guys, stopped in, sang a few songs, and then left. 4 speeches that he gives. Are they any different, fundamentally different in tone and content of the friends? Does he add any new insight? Does he get the reader a little closer to the truth about Job's predicament? I looked at this now a lot different than I did when I taught this class years ago. I may have been right then and wrong now, or right now and wrong then. I can see the point of each one. Bottom line, either way, doesn't change the meaning of the book. But it also means we can't just ignore what he says. But we'll go into more depth than what we're going to right now. But I will say this when it concerns Elihu. God completely, 100% ignores him. After Elihu finishes speaking, turn with me to Job 38. Elihu finishes his last speech in chapter 37. Chapter 38. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" Who does the Lord answer? Job. What is it? And the question, what is it that Job wants more than anything in this book? To speak to God. One thing about Elihu that we'll look at here in a minute. Elihu says, there ain't no way that God is going to talk to you. Elihu repeatedly accuses Job of sin. In Job 33:8-12, he accuses it of sin. He makes the same accusations that are false about Job that the friends did. Nothing new. In fact, he says Job travels in companions with evildoers in chapter 34 and verse 8. He says Job answers like wicked men and adds rebellion to his sin, chapter 34, 36, and 37. And as a result, Job now is full of judgment on the wicked, 36 verse 17. Elihu is way off, just like the friends are. And not even that. What is it that, and I don't watch any of this, Jess. I don't watch any of this politician stuff or any of it. And maybe I should at least a little bit, because I might wake up one day and this world's gone. That's not bad. But what is it that politicians and people do to one another? They twist their words. They take them out of context. They say things and pull it out like this is what this guy said, when it's not even in context. That's exactly what Elihu does. In chapter 21, verse 14 and 15, well, y'all got there? Wait, then you just stay right there and let me read 34 and verse 9. This is what Elihu says about Job. "For he has said, it profits a man nothing when he is pleased with God." That's a strong accusation to say. What he's doing is he's taking what Job said here in 21:14. They, and he's talking about evil people, not himself, spend their days in prosperity and suddenly they go down to Sheol. They say to God, "Depart from us. We do not even desire the knowledge of your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what would we gain if we entreat him?" This isn't the way Job feels. This is Job seeing that this principle of retribution may not be the comprehensive answer. And Elihu takes it out of context and says, "That's what you said." Well, we see that all the time in today's world. Doing some editing here. Elihu adds nothing, as I said, to this discussion between Job and his friends. He also believes in the principle of retribution as well, Job 34 and verse 11. He contends that Job will never see God, and that is wrong. That's what Job wants more than anything. And in fact, he's so confident that he won't see God. Chapter 34 in verse 23. For he does not need to consider a man further, that he should go before God in judgment. But he does wish that Job would make his case before God, because then Job would get the punishment he really deserves. Verse 36 and 37 of chapter 34. But then he goes on to say, but that's not going to happen because God doesn't really listen to any of us. Not even the truly oppressed, and certainly not you, Job. That's in chapter 35, 9 to 14. As far as Elihu is concerned, God is totally inaccessible. Look at 37. Verse 23 and 24. Elihu says, the Almighty, we cannot find him. He is exalted in power, and he will not do violence to justice and abundant righteousness. Therefore men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise of heart. What? And that it's impossible to take your case before him, Job. Look at verse 19, same chapter. Teach us what we shall say to him. We cannot arrange our case because of darkness. We can't go before God because of our sin. Job, you cannot have what you want. You will not have what you want. And you know what? When God, in chapter 42, rebukes the three friends, Elihu is not mentioned there either. Interesting. He claims that he would never, ever be able to see God, which is what Job has been saying that he wants to see, and then out of the whirlwind, here comes God. In chapter 38, the Lord answered Job, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you will instruct me. The question, one of the questions that I ask is, what are these speeches and answers by God? What is he trying to show Job? He tells him, you're speaking words without knowledge. Has anyone ever said things and not have all the knowledge about it? Have you ever made a comment about someone not knowing the full story and you jump to a conclusion? That's what Job is being asked about here. What we see are these type of questions by God to Job. Where were you when I did this? Have you done this? Where is he? Who has done this? Who can? Can you? Do you know all these things about creation? So why does God ask these type of questions? Is it because he's trying to show Job, I'm all powerful and you're not? Is it that he's trying to show that he has this power that's beyond our thinking, beyond our wisdom? But what about what James said? That the Lord is full of compassion and is merciful. I have some different views on what I thought about this as well. Just because we can't see or do it or even understand it does not mean God didn't do it and isn't still doing it. That is taking care of it. This is what God is teaching. and what he is presenting. I think when you study this closely, and hopefully in our study, you'll see this as well. But, you know, Job is concerned about what has happened between him and God. And he is letting him know, you don't understand some things that I'm doing. What you need to understand is, you can't put me in a nice little triangle and figure everything out. It's not that simple. But you need to understand that I'm taking care of things. Colossians 1:16 and 17. For by Him, Christ, all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authority, all things have been created through Him and for Him. Verse 17. He is before all things, and here's what I'm looking at. And in Him, all things hold together. What does that mean? The universe, everything, continues to exist through His power. God is not still resting. The power of His Word. Things are held together in Christ. Things are sustained. He is sustaining creation. He is still working. He is still doing things. In Acts 17, 27 and 28, when Paul is speaking to those in Athens, look at verse 28. For in Him we live and move and exist. That is present tense. God exercises His authority over creation. Jehovah is providentially in control of this world, including our movements, our living, our existence. Just because we can't see it or understand it doesn't mean that God isn't still working and taking care of things. I need to hurry up here. No, I'm not ready for that one yet. Look at chapter 38, if you would, verse 39. All the way through chapter 38, or all of chapter 38 has been wonderful things about creation. Then he says, can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lion as they crouch in their dens and lie wait in their lair? Who prepares for the raven its nourishment? When its young cries to who? To God, and wander about without food. All of a sudden, there's a transition. In chapter 39, it continues. God now speaks about wild animals. And I don't know if any of you have seen National Geographic or any of those shows, but they go in with their cameras in parts of the world and they're seeing things that they don't even know what it is or why they're doing it. And yet God created it and is taking care of them. Can you do that, Job? Well, let's get more to the point. All of these wild animals are now mentioned. In verse 5 of chapter 39, he says, who set out the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the swift donkey to whom I gave the wilderness for a home and the salt land for his dwelling? He scorns the tumult of the city, the shoutings of the driver he does not hear. He explores the mountains for his pasture and searches every green thing. Why in the world is God bringing up this animal? The reason He is bringing it up, because Job brought it up. We'll get into this later. I'm just going to, instead of reading all through of it, because we're running short on time, Job compares himself to a wild donkey. And he mentions the fact that the only time you hear a wild donkey bray and make noise is when he doesn't have food. He says, I'm a wild donkey. He goes on and he also brings it up again in chapter 24, verses 4 and 5, about being compared to a wild donkey because they're out in the middle of nowhere where no one cares about them. No one cares about the wild ox, which he also compared himself to. No one cares about these animals. They're in the middle of the wild. They're forgotten. They're a nowhere man in a nowhere land. And God says, Job, I care about these animals. And I take care of them. And I know exactly what's going on. That sound familiar? Jesus said he knew exactly about those birds and how he took care of them. This is exactly what's happening here in these speeches. They're not this thing pulled out of nowhere. There's a point to them. God knows, God cares. Job thinks that his relationship with God, he feels like that wild donkey. He felt abandoned. And he wanted more than anything to bring his case before him, because it hurt, as much as it hurt to lose everything he had, it hurt more to lose God. That's why he's called blameless and upright. And he showed Satan wrong, and that's why Satan runs and flees after the second chapter. Here's what this book ends. God is asking Job, do you trust me? Do you trust me? I know you lost your children. I know you loved them. I know your wife is in pain and doubting. I know you are. I know you lost these men who worked for you. I know everything you're going through. But you haven't been forgotten. You have not been forgotten. I am not your enemy. Do you trust me? Everything you've gone through, do you trust me? And Job says, yes, I do. Chapter 42, Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. No matter what happens, no matter how many bad things happen, God's will be done. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have declared that which I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Hear now, and I will speak. I will ask you, you will instruct me. Notice verse 5. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear. What did he want more than anything in this book? To see God. But now my eye sees you. It would not, had he not gone through what he went through. Has Job been given all the wonderful things back to him at this point? Absolutely not. He has not. He trusts God. Does Job fear God for no reason? Yes, he does. Satan is wrong again, but he will not give up. We'll go into this a little more deeper. But this, I wanted to do a two-lesson overview of the book, then to go into it a little more. Please do what you can with these lists and these things. It is like the things that I've learned from Brother Shane Scott in this book, along with the studying I've done on my own, has just been such a thrill. But we're going to sing Nothing But the Blood. There is that answer. There's an answer we see in the book. That sin that's there is washed away by Christ. The one who could lay his hand on man and lay his hand on God and know how God feels and know how man feels, basically so we can know that he knows, so that we can feel that. And then to have him be our advocate and to be our judge and the one that laid down the sacrifice, what more could we ask for than what God has given us through his Son? If we can help in any way, please stand while we sing.